What Jessie saw through her sunglasses and her homemade filter was so strange and so awesome that at first her mind refused to grasp it. There seemed to be a vast round beauty mark, like the one below the corner of Anne Francis's mouth, hanging there in the afternoon sky. "If I talk in my sleep, 'cause I haven't seen my baby all week." It was at this point that she first felt her father's hand on the nub of her right breast. It squeezed gently for a moment, drifted across to the left one, then returned to the right again, as if he were making a size comparison. He was breathing very fast now. The respiration in her ear was like a steam engine, and she was again aware of that hard thing pressing against her bottom. "Can I get a witness?" Marvin Gaye, that auctioneer of soul, was shouting. "Witness! Witness!" "Daddy? Are you all right?" She felt a delicate tingle in her breasts again. Pleasure and pain. Roast turkey with a knee-high glaze and chocolate gravy. But this time she also felt alarm and a kind of startled confusion. "Yes," he said. But his voice sounded almost like the voice of a stranger. "Yes, fine. But don't look around." The hand which had been on her breasts went somewhere else. The one on her thigh moved up further, pushing the hem of the sundress ahead of it. "Daddy, what are you doing?" Her question was not exactly fearful. Mostly it was curious. Still, there was an undertone of fear there, something like a length of fine red thread. Above her, a furnace of strange light glowed fiercely around the dark circle hanging in the indigo sky. "Do you love me, Pumpkin?" "Yes, sure." "Then don't worry about anything. I'd never hurt you. I want to be sweet to you. Just watch the eclipse and let me be sweet to you." "I'm not sure I want to, Daddy." That sense of confusion was growing deeper. The red thread was fattening. "I'm afraid of burning my eyes, burning my whatchamacallums." "But I believe," Marvin sang, "a woman's a man's best friend, and I'm gonna stick by her to the very end." "Don't worry." He was panting now. "You have another 20 seconds. At least that. So don't worry. And don't look around." She heard the snap of elastic, but it was his, not hers. Her underpants were where they were supposed to be, although she realized that if she looked down, she would be able to see them. That was how far up he had pushed her dress. "Do you love me?" he asked again. And although she was gripped by a terrible premonition that the right answer to this question had become the wrong one, she was 10 years old, and it was still the only answer she had to give. She told him that she did. "Witness! Witness!" Marvin pleaded, fading out now. Her father shifted, pressing the hard thing more firmly against her bottom. Jessie suddenly realized what it was. Not the handle of a screwdriver or the tack hammer from the toolbox in the pantry, that was for sure. And the alarm she felt was matched by a momentary spiteful pleasure, which had more to do with her mother than with her father. "This is what you get for not sticking up for me," she thought, looking at the dark circle in the sky through the layers of smoked glass, and then, "I guess this is what we both get." Her vision suddenly blurred and the pleasure was gone. Only the mounting sense of alarm was left. "Oh, geez," she thought. "It's my retinas. It must be my retinas starting to burn." The hand on her thigh now moved between her legs, slid up until it was stopped by her crotch, and cupped her firmly there. "He shouldn't be doing that," she thought. It was the wrong place for his hand. Unless... "He's goosing you," a voice inside suddenly spoke up. In later years, that voice, which she eventually came to think of as that of the goodwife, frequently filled her with exasperation. It was sometimes the voice of caution, often the voice of blame, and almost always the voice of denial. Unpleasant things, demeaning things, painful things, they would all go away eventually if you ignored them enthusiastically enough. That was the goodwife's view. It was a voice apt to stubbornly insist that even the most obvious wrongs were actually rights, parts of a benign plan too large and complex for mere mortals to grasp. There would be times, mostly during her 11th and 12th years, when she called that voice Miss Petrie after her second grade teacher, when she would actually raise her hands to her ears to try and blot out that quacking, reasonable voice, useless, of course, since it originated on the side of her ears she couldn't get to. But in that moment of dawning dismay, while the eclipse darkened the skies over western Maine and reflected stars burned in the depths of Darkscore Lake, that moment when she realized, sort of, what the hand between her legs was up to, she heard only kindness and practicality, and she seized upon what the voice was saying with panicky relief. "It's just a goose, that's all it is, Jessie." "Are you sure?" she cried back. "Yes," the voice replied firmly. As the years went by, Jessie would discover that this voice was always sure, wrong or right. "He means it as a joke, that's all. He doesn't know he's scaring you, so don't open your mouth and spoil a lovely afternoon. This is no big deal." "Don't you believe it, Toots," the other voice, the tough voice, responded. "Sometimes he behaves as if you're his goddamn girlfriend instead of his daughter. And that's what he's doing right now. He's not goosing you, Jessie. He's fucking you." She was almost positive that was a lie. Almost positive that strange and forbidden schoolyard word referred to an act that could not be accomplished with just a hand. But doubts remained. With sudden dismay, she remembered Karen Aucoin telling her not to ever let a boy put his tongue in her mouth, because it could start a baby in her throat. Karen said it sometimes happened that way, but that a woman who had to vomit her baby to get it out almost always died, and usually the baby died too. "I ain't ever going to let a boy French kiss me," Karen said. "I might let one feel me on top if I really loved him, but I don't ever want a baby in my throat. How would you eat?" At the time, Jessie had found this concept of pregnancy so crazy it was almost charming. And who but Karen Aucoin, who worried about whether or not the light stayed on when you shut the refrigerator door, could have come up with such a thing? Now, however, the idea shimmered with its own weird logic. Suppose, just suppose it was true. If you could get a baby from a boy's tongue, if that could happen, then... And there was that hard thing pressing into her bottom. A thing that wasn't the handle of a screwdriver or her mother's tack hammer. Jessie tried to squeeze her legs together, a gesture that was ambivalent to her, but apparently not to him. He gasped, a painful, scary sound, and pressed his fingers harder against the sensitive mound just beneath the crotch of her underpants. It hurt a little. She stiffened against him and moaned. It occurred to her much later that her father very likely misinterpreted that sound as passion, and it was probably just as well that he did. Whatever his interpretation, it signaled the climax of this strange interlude. He arched suddenly beneath her, sending her smoothly upward. The movement was both terrifying and strangely pleasurable, that he should be so strong, that she should be so moved. For one moment she almost understood the nature of the chemicals at work here, dangerous yet compelling, and that control of them might lie within her grasp, if she wanted to control them, that was. "I don't," she thought. "I don't want anything to do with it. Whatever it is, it's nasty and horrible and scary." Then the hard thing pressed against her buttock, The thing that wasn't the handle of a screwdriver or her mother's tack hammer was spasming. And some liquid was spreading there, soaking a hot spot through her pants. "It's sweat," the voice which would one day belong to the goodwife said promptly. "That's what it is. He sensed you were afraid of him, afraid to be on his lap, and that made him nervous. You ought to be sorry." "Sweat my eye," the other voice, the one which would one day belong to Ruth, returned. It spoke quietly, forcefully, fearfully. "You know what it is, Jesse. It's the stuff you heard Maddie and those other girls talking about the night Maddie had her slumber party, after they thought you were finally asleep. Cindy Lessard called it spunk. She said it was white, and that it squirts out of a guy's thing like toothpaste. That's the stuff that makes babies, not French kissing." For a moment, she balanced up there, on the stiff lift of his wave, confused and afraid and somehow excited, listening to him snatch one harsh breath after another out of the humid air. Then his hips and thighs slowly relaxed, and he lowered her back down. "Don't look at it any longer, Pumpkin," he said. And although he was still panting, his voice was almost normal again. That scary excitement had gone out of it, and there was no ambivalence about what she felt now. Deep, simple relief. Whatever had happened, if anything really had, it was over. "Daddy?" "Nope. Don't argue. Your time is up." He took the stack of smoked glass panes gently from her hand. At the same time, he kissed her neck, even more gently. Jesse stared out at the weird darkness cloaking the lake as he did it. She was faintly aware that the owl was still calling, and that the crickets had been fooled into beginning their evensongs 2 or 3 hours early. An afterimage floated in front of her eyes like a round black tattoo surrounded by an irregular halo of green fire, and she thought, "If I looked at it too long, if I burned my retinas, I'll probably have to look at that for the rest of my life, like what you see after someone shoots off a flashbulb in your eyes. Why don't you go inside and change into jeans, Pumpkin? I guess maybe the sundress wasn't such a good idea after all." He spoke in a dull, emotionless voice that seemed to suggest that wearing the sundress had been all her idea. "Even if it wasn't, you should have known better," the Miss Petrie voice said instantly. And a new idea suddenly occurred to her. What if he decided he had to tell Mom about what had happened? The possibility was so horrifying that Jesse burst into tears. "I'm sorry, Daddy," she wept, throwing her arms around him and pressing her face into the hollow of his neck, smelling the vague and ghostly aroma of his aftershave or cologne or whatever it was. "If I did something wrong, I'm really, really, really sorry." "God, no," he said. But he still spoke in that dull, preoccupied voice, as if he was trying to decide if he should tell Sally what Jesse had done, or if it could perhaps be swept under the rug. "You didn't do anything wrong, Pumpkin."
"Do you still love me?"
she persisted. It occurred to her that she was mad to ask, mad to risk an answer which might devastate her, but she had to ask, had to. "Of course," he replied at once. A little more animation came into his voice as he said it, enough to make her understand that he was telling the truth, and oh, what a relief that was. But she still suspected things had changed, and all because of something she barely understood. She knew the goose. It was a goose, just a kind of goose. Had had something to do with sex, but she had had no idea just how much or how serious it might have been. It probably wasn't what the girls at the slumber party had called going all the way, except for the strangely knowledgeable Cindy Lessard. She had called it deep-sea diving with a long white pole, a term which had struck Jesse as both horrible and hilarious. But the fact that he hadn't put his thing in her thing still might not mean she was safe from being what some of the girls, even at her school, called PG. What Karen Aucoin had told her last year when they were walking home from school recurred to her, and Jesse tried to shut it out. It almost certainly wasn't true, and he hadn't stuck his tongue in her mouth even if it was. In her mind, she heard her mother's voice, loud and angry.
"Don't they say it's always the squeaky wheel that always gets the grease?"
She felt the hot, wet spot against her buttocks. It was still spreading. "Yes," she thought. "I guess that's right. I guess the squeaky wheel does get the grease. Daddy." He raised his hand, a gesture he often made at the dinner table, when her mother or Maddie, usually her mother, started getting hot under the collar about something. Jesse couldn't remember Daddy ever making this gesture to her, and it reinforced her feeling that something had gone horribly awry here, and that there were apt to be fundamental, unappealing changes as the result of some terrible error, probably agreeing to wear the sundress she had made. This idea caused a feeling of sorrow so deep it felt like invisible fingers working ruthlessly inside her. In the corner of her eye, she noticed that her father's gym shorts were askew. Something was poking out, something pink, and it sure as hell wasn't the handle of a screwdriver. Before she could look away, Tom Mayhoot caught the direction of her glance and quickly adjusted his shorts, causing the pink thing to disappear. His face contracted in a momentary moue of disgust, and Jesse cringed inside again. He had caught her looking, and had mistaken her random glance for unseemly curiosity. "What just happened?" he began, then cleared his throat. "We need to talk about what just happened, Punkin. But not right this minute. Dash inside and change your clothes. Maybe take a quick shower while you're at it. Hurry up so you don't miss the end of the eclipse." She had lost all interest in the eclipse, although she would never tell him that in a million years. She nodded instead, then turned back.
"Daddy, am I all right?"
He looked surprised, unsure, wary. A combination which increased the feeling that angry hands were at work inside her, kneading her guts. And she suddenly understood that he felt as badly as she did, perhaps worse. And in an instant of clarity, untouched by any voice save her own, she thought,
"You ought to! Jeepers, you started it!"
"Yes," he said. But his tone did not entirely convince her. "Right as rain, Jess. Now go on inside and fix yourself up." "All right." She tried to smile, tried hard, and actually succeeded a little. Her father looked startled for a moment, and then he returned her smile. That relieved her somewhat, and the hands which had been working inside her temporarily loosened their grip. By the time she had reached the big upstairs bedroom she shared with Maddie, however, the feelings had begun to return. The worst by far was the fear that he would feel he had to tell her mother about what had happened. And what would her mother think?
"That's our Jesse, isn't it? The squeaky wheel."
The bedroom had been divided off girls at camp style with a clothesline strung down the middle. She and Maddie had hung some old sheets their mother had given them on this line, and then colored bright designs on them with Will's Crayolas. Coloring the sheets and dividing the room had been great fun at the time, but it seemed stupid and kiddish to her now. And the way her overblown shadow danced on the center sheet was actually scary. It looked like the shadow of a monster. Even the fragrant smell of pine resin, which she usually liked, seemed heavy and cloying to her, like an air freshener you sprayed around heavily to cover up some unpleasant stink. "That's our Jessie. Never quite satisfied with arrangements until she gets to put on the finishing touches. Never quite happy with someone else's plans. Never able to let well enough alone." She hurried into the bathroom, wanting to outrun that voice, rightly guessing she wouldn't be able to. She turned on the light and pulled the sundress over her head in one quick jerk. She threw it into the laundry hamper, glad to be rid of it. She looked at herself in the mirror, wide-eyed, and saw a little girl's face surrounded by a big girl's hairdo, one which was now coming loose from the pins in strands and puffs and locks. It was a little girl's body, too, flat-chested and slim-hipped, but it wouldn't be that way for long. It had already started to change, and it had done something to her father it had no business doing. "I never want boobs and curvy hips," she thought dully. "If they make things like this happen, who would?" The thought made her aware of that wet spot on the seat of her underpants again. She slipped out of them. Cotton pants from Sears, once green, now so faded they were closer to gray, and held them up curiously, her hands inside the waistband. There was something on the back of them, all right, and it wasn't sweat, nor did it look like any kind of toothpaste she had ever seen. What it looked like was pearly gray dish detergent. What she smelled was a faint, flat odor which she associated with a lake after a run of hot, still weather, and with their well water all the time. She once took her father a glass of water which smelled particularly strong to her, and asked if he could smell it. He had shaken his head. "Nope," he said cheerfully. "But that doesn't mean it isn't there. It just means I smoke too damn much. My guess is that it's the smell of the aquifer, Punkin. Trace minerals, that's all. A little smelly, and it means your mother has to spend a fortune on fabric softener. But it won't hurt you. Swear to God." Trace minerals, she thought now, and sniffed that bland aroma again. She was unable to think why it fascinated her, but it did. The smell of the aquifer, that's all. The smell of... Then the more assertive voice spoke up. On the afternoon of the eclipse, it sounded a bit like her mother's voice. It called her Tootsie, for one thing, as Sally sometimes did when she was irritated with Jessie, for shirking some chore, or forgetting some responsibility. But Jessie had an idea it was really the voice of her own adult self. If its combative bray was a little distressing, that was only because it was too early for that voice, strictly speaking. It was here just the same, though. It was here, and it was doing the best it could to put her back together again. She found its brassy loudness oddly comforting. "It's the stuff Cindy Lessard was talking about, that's what it is. It's his spunk, Tootsie. I suppose you ought to be grateful it ended up on your underwear instead of someplace else. But don't go telling yourself any fairy tales about how it's the lake you smell, or trace minerals from deep down in the aquifer, or anything else. Karen Aucoin is a dipshit. There was never a woman in the history of the world who grew a baby in her throat, and you know it. But Cindy Lessard is no dipshit. I think she's seen this stuff. And now you've seen it, too. Man stuff. Spunk." Suddenly revolted, not so much by what it was as from whom it had originated, Jessie threw the underpants into the hamper on top of the sundress. Then she had a vision of her mother, who emptied the hampers and did the wash in the dank basement laundry room, fishing this particular pair of panties out of this particular hamper, and finding this particular deposit. And what would she think? Why, that the family's troublesome squeaky wheel had gotten the grease, of course. What else? Her revulsion turned to guilty horror, and Jessie quickly fished the underpants back out. All at once the flat odor seemed to fill her nose, thick and bland and sickening. Oysters and copper, she thought, and that was all it took. She fell on her knees in front of the toilet, the underpants wadded up in one clenched hand, and vomited. She flushed quickly before the smell of partly digested hamburger could get into the air, then turned on the cold sink tap and rinsed her mouth out. Her fear that she was going to spend the next hour or so in here, kneeling in front of the toilet and puking, began to subside. Her stomach seemed to be settling. If she could just keep from getting another whiff of that bland, copper-creamy smell. Holding her breath, she thrust the panties under the cold tap, rinsed them, wrung them out, and flung them back in the hamper. Then she took a deep breath, pushing her hair away from her temples with the backs of her damp hands at the same time. If her mother asked her what a damp pair of panties was doing in the dirty clothes, "Already you're thinking like a criminal," the voice that would one day belong to the good wife mourned. "Do you see what being a bad girl gets you, Jessie? Do you? I certainly hope you do." "Be quiet, you little creep," the other voice snarled back. "You can nag all you want later on, but right now we're trying to take care of a little business here, if you don't mind, okay?" No answer. That was good. Jessie brushed nervously at her hair again, although very little of it had fallen back down against her temples. If her mother asked what the damp panties were doing in the dirty clothes hamper, Jessie would simply say it was so hot that she went for a dip without changing out of her shorts. All three of them had done that on several occasions this summer. "Then you better remember to run your shorts and shirt under the tap, too. Right, Toots?" "Right," she agreed. "Good point." She slipped into the robe hanging on the back of the bathroom door and returned to the bedroom to get the shorts and the T-shirt she'd been wearing when her mother, brother, and older sister left that morning. 1,000 years ago, it now seemed. She didn't see them at first, and got down on her knees to look under the bed. "The other woman is on her knees, too," a voice remarked. "And she smells that same smell. That smell that's like copper and cream." Jessie heard but didn't hear. Her mind was on her shorts and her T-shirt, on her cover story. As she had suspected, they were under the bed. She reached for them. "It's coming out of the well," the voice remarked further. "The smell from the well." "Yes, yes," Jessie thought, grabbing the clothes and starting back to the bathroom. "The smell from the well, very good. You're a poet and you don't know it." "She made him fall down the well," the voice said. And that finally got through. Jessie came to a dead stop in the bathroom doorway, her eyes widening. She was suddenly afraid in some new and deadly way. Now that she was actually listening to it, she realized that this voice was not like any of the others. This one was like a voice you might pick up on the radio late at night, when conditions were exactly right. A voice that might come from far, far away. "Not that far, Jessie. She is in the path of the eclipse, too." For one moment, the upper hallway of the house on Darkscore Lake seemed to be gone. What replaced it was a tangle of blackberry bushes, shadowless under the eclipse-darkened sky, and a clear smell of sea salt. Jessie saw a skinny woman in a house dress with her salt-and-pepper hair put up in a bun. She was kneeling by a splintered square of boards. There was a puddle of white fabric beside her. Jessie was quite sure it was the skinny woman's slip. "Who are you?" Jessie asked the woman. But she was already gone. If she had ever been there in the first place, that was. Jessie actually glanced over her shoulder to see if perhaps that spooky skinny woman had gotten behind her. But the upstairs hallway was deserted. She was alone. She looked down at her arms and saw they were rippled with goose flesh. "You're losing your mind," the voice that would one day be Goodwife Burlingame mourned. "Oh, Jessie, you've been bad. You've been very bad. And now you're going to have to pay by losing your mind." "I'm not," she said. She looked at her pale, strained face in the bathroom mirror. "I'm not!" She waited for a moment in a kind of horrified suspension to see if any of the voices, or the image of the woman kneeling by the splintered boards with her slip puddled on the ground beside her, would come back. But she neither heard nor saw anything. creepy other who had told Jesse some she had pushed some he down some well was apparently gone. Strain, Toots, the voice that would one day be Ruth advised. And Jesse had a clear idea that while the voice didn't exactly believe that, it had decided Jesse had better get moving again, and right away. You thought about a woman with a slip beside her because you've got underwear on the brain this afternoon, that's all. I'd forget the whole thing if I were you. That was great advice. Jesse quickly dampened her shorts and shirt under the tap, wrung them out, and then stepped into the shower. She soaped, rinsed, dried, hurried back to the bedroom. She ordinarily wouldn't have bothered with a robe again for the quick dash across the hall, but this time she did, only holding it shut instead of taking time to belt it closed. She paused in the bedroom again, biting her lip, praying that the weird other voice wouldn't come back, praying that she wouldn't have another of those crazy hallucinations or illusions or whatever they were. Nothing came. She dropped the robe on her bed, hurried across to her bureau, pulled on fresh underwear and shorts. She smells that same smell, she thought. Whoever that woman is, she smells the same smell coming out of the well she made the man fall into, and it's happening now during the eclipse. I'm sure. She turned, a fresh blouse in one hand, and then froze. Her father was standing in the doorway, watching her. Jesse awoke in the mild, milky light of dawn, with a perplexing and ominous memory of the woman still filling her mind. The woman with her graying hair pulled back in that tight countrywoman's bun. The woman who had been kneeling in the blackberry tangles with her slip puddled beside her. The woman who had been looking down through broken boards and smelling that awful, bland smell. Jesse hadn't thought of that woman in years. And now, fresh from her dream of 1963 that hadn't been a dream but a recollection, it seemed to her that she had been granted some sort of supernatural vision on that day. A vision that had perhaps been caused by stress and then lost again for the same reason. But it didn't matter. Not that. Not what happened with her father out on the deck. Not what had happened later, when she had turned around to see him standing in the bedroom door. All that had happened a long time ago. And as for what was happening right now, I'm in trouble. I think I'm in very serious trouble. She lay back against the pillows and looked up at her suspended arms. She felt as dazed and helpless as a poisoned insect in a spider's web, wanting no more than to be asleep again, dreamlessly this time if possible, with her dead arms and dry throat in another universe. No such luck. There was a slow, somnolent buzzing sound somewhere close by. Her first thought was alarm clock. Her second, after 2 or 3 minutes of dozing with her eyes open, was smoke detector. That idea caused a brief, groundless burst of hope, which brought her a little closer to real waking. She realized that what she was hearing didn't really sound very much like a smoke detector at all. It sounded like, well, like, "It's flies, Toots, okay?" The no-bullshit voice now sounded tired and wan. "You've heard about the boys of summer, haven't you? Well, these are the flies of autumn, and their version of the World Series is currently being played on Gerald Burlingame, the noted attorney and handcuff fetishist." "Jesus, I gotta get up," she said in a croaking, husky voice she barely recognized as her own. "What the hell does that mean?" she thought. And it was the answer. Not a goddamn thing, thanks very much. That finished the job of bringing her back to full wakefulness. She didn't want to be awake, but she had an idea that she had better accept the fact that she was, and do as much with it as she could while she could. "And you probably better start by waking up your hands and arms. If they will wake up, that is." She looked at her right arm, then turned her head on the rusty armature of her neck, which was only partially asleep, and looked at her left. Jessie realized with sudden shock that she was looking at them in a completely new way, looking at them as she might have looked at pieces of furniture in a showroom window. They seemed to have no business with Jessie Burlingame at all, and she supposed there was nothing so odd about that, not really. They were, after all, utterly without feeling. Sensation only started a little below her armpits. She tried to pull herself up and was dismayed to find the mutiny in her arms had gone further than she suspected. Not only did they refuse to move her, they refused to move themselves. Her brains were totally ignored. She looked up at them again, and they no longer looked like furniture to her. Now they looked like pallid cuts of meat hanging from butcher's hooks, and she let out a hoarse cry of fear and anger. Never mind, though. The arms weren't happening, at least for the time being, and being mad or afraid or both wasn't going to change that a bit. How about the fingers? If she could curl them around the bedposts, then maybe... or maybe not. Her fingers seemed as useless as her arms. After nearly a full minute of effort, Jessie was rewarded only by a single numb twitch from her right thumb. Dear God, she said in her grating dust-in-the-cracks voice. There was no anger in it now, only fear. People died in accidents, of course. She supposed she had seen hundreds, perhaps even thousands of death clips on the TV news during her lifetime. Body bags carried away from wrecked cars or winched out of the jungle in medevac slings, feet sticking out from beneath hastily spread blankets while buildings burned in the background. White-faced, stumble-voiced witnesses pointing to pools of sticky dark stuff in alleys or on barroom floors. She had seen the white-shrouded shape that had been John Belushi, toted out of the Chateau Marmont Hotel in Los Angeles. She had seen aerialist Carl Wallenda lose his balance, fall heavily to the cable he had been trying to cross. It had been strung between two resort hotels, she seemed to remember, clutch it briefly, and then plunge to his death below. The news programs had played that one over and over, as if obsessed with it. So she knew people died in accidents. Of course she knew it. But until now, she had somehow never realized there were people inside those people. People just like her. People who hadn't the slightest idea they would ever eat another cheeseburger, watch another round of Final Jeopardy, and please make sure your answer is in the form of a question, or call their best friends to say that penny poker on Thursday night or shopping on Saturday afternoon seemed like a great idea. No more beer, no more kisses, and your fantasy of making love in a hammock during a thunderstorm was never going to be fulfilled, because you were going to be too busy being dead. Any morning you rolled out of bed might be your last. It's a lot more than a case of might this morning, Jessie thought. I think now it's a case of probably. The house, our nice, quiet lakeside house, may very well be on the news Friday or Saturday night. It'll be Doug Rowe wearing that white trench coat of his I hate so much, and talking into his microphone and calling it the house where prominent Portland lawyer Gerald Burlingame and his wife Jessie died. And he'll send it back to the studio and Bill Green will do the sports. And that isn't being morbid, Jessie. That isn't the good wife moaning or Ruth ranting. It's... But Jessie knew. It was the truth. It was just a silly little accident. The kind of thing you shook your head over when you saw it reported in the paper at breakfast. You said, "Listen to this, honey," and read the item to your husband while he ate his grapefruit. Just a silly little accident. Only this time it was happening to her. Her mind's constant insistence that it was a mistake was understandable, but irrelevant. There was no complaint department where she could explain that the handcuffs had been Gerald's idea, and so it was only fair that she should be let off. If the mistake was going to be rectified, she would have to be the one to do it. Jessie cleared her throat, closed her eyes, and spoke to the ceiling. God, listen a minute, would you? I need some help here. I really do. I'm in a mess. and I'm terrified. Please help me get out of this, okay? I pray in the name of Jesus Christ. She struggled to amplify this prayer and could only come up with something Nora Callaghan had taught her. A prayer which now seemed to be on the lips of every self-help huckster and dipshit guru in the world. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Nothing changed. She felt no serenity, no courage, most certainly no wisdom. She was still only a woman with dead arms and a dead husband, cuffed to the posts of this bed like a cur dog chained to a ring bolt, and left to die unremarked and unlamented in a dusty backyard, while his tossed-pot master serves 30 days in the county clink for driving without a license and under the influence. "Oh, please don't let it hurt," she said in a low, trembling voice. "If I'm going to die, God, please don't let it hurt. I'm such a baby about pain." "Thinking about dying at this point is probably a really bad idea, Toots." Ruth's voice paused, then added, "On second thought, strike the probably." Okay, no argument. Thinking about dying was a bad idea. So what did that leave? Living. Ruth and Goodwife Burlingame said it at the same time. All right, living. Which brought her around full circle to her arms again. They're asleep because I've been hanging on them all night. I'm still hanging on them. Getting the weight off is step one. She tried to push herself backward and upward with her feet again, and felt a sudden weight of black panic when they at first also refused to move. She lost herself for a few moments then, and when she came back she was pistoning her legs rapidly up and down, pushing the coverlet, the sheets, and the mattress pad down to the foot of the bed. She was gasping for breath like a bicycle racer topping the last steep hill in a marathon race. Her butt, which had also gone to sleep, sang and zipped with wake-up needles. Fear had gotten her fully awake, but it took the half-assed aerobics which accompanied her panic to kick her heart all the way up into passing gear. At last she began to feel tingles of sensation, bone-deep and as ominous as distant thunder, in her arms. "If nothing else works, Toots, keep your mind on those last 2 or 3 sips of water. Keep reminding yourself that you're never going to get hold of that glass again unless your hands and arms are in good working order, let alone drink from it." Jessie continued to push with her feet as the morning brightened. Sweat plastered her hair against her temples and streamed down her cheeks. She was aware, vaguely, that she was deepening her water debt every moment she persisted in this strenuous activity, but she saw no choice. "Because there is none, Toots. None at all." "Toots this and Toots that," she thought distractedly. "Would you please put a sock in it, you mouthy bitch?" At last her bottom began to slide up toward the head of the bed. Each time it moved, Jessie tensed her stomach muscles and did a mini sit-up. The angle made by her upper and lower body slowly began to approach 90 degrees. Her elbows began to bend, and as the drag of her weight began to leave her arms and shoulders, the tingles racing through her flesh increased. She didn't stop moving her legs when she was finally sitting up, but continued to pedal, wanting to keep her heart rate up. A drop of stinging sweat ran into her left eye. She flicked it away with an impatient shake of her head and went on pedaling. The tingles continued to increase, darting upward and downward from her elbows, and about 5 minutes after she'd reached her current slumped position, she looked like a gawky teenager draped over a movie theater seat. The first cramp struck. It felt like a blow from the dull side of a meat cleaver. Jessie threw her head back, sending a fine mist of perspiration flying from her head and hair, and shrieked. As she was drawing breath to repeat the cry, the second cramp struck. This one was much worse. It felt as if someone had dropped a glass-crusted noose of cable around her left shoulder and then yanked it tight. She howled, her hands snapping shut into fists with such sudden savagery that two of her fingernails splintered away from the quick and began to bleed. Her eyes, sunk into brown hollows of puffy flesh, were squeezed tightly shut. But tears escaped nevertheless and went trickling down her cheeks, mixing with the runnels of sweat from her hairline. "Keep pedaling, Toots. Don't stop now."
"Don't you call me Toots!"
Jessie screamed. The stray dog had crept back to the rear stoop just before first light, and at the sound of her voice its head jerked up. There was an almost comical expression of surprise on its face.
"Don't you call me that, you bitch, you hateful bitch!"
Another cramp. This one as sharp and sudden as a thunderbolt coronary, punched through her left tricep all the way to the armpit, and her words dissolved into a long, wavering scream of agony. Yet she kept on pedaling. Somehow, she kept on pedaling. When the worst of the cramps had passed, at least she hoped the worst of them had, she took a breather, leaning back against the slatted mahogany crossboards which formed the head of the bed, her eyes closed and her breath gradually slowing down, first to a lope, then a trot, and finally to a walk. Thirst or no thirst, she felt surprisingly good. She supposed part of the reason lay in that old joke, the one with a punchline that went, "It feels so good when I stop." But she had been an athletic girl and an athletic woman until 5 years ago. Well, all right. Maybe it was closer to 10. And she could still recognize an endorphin rush when she was having one. Absurd, given the circumstances, but also very nice.
Maybe not so absurd, Jess.
Maybe useful. Those endorphins clear the mind, which is one reason why people work better after they've taken some exercise. And her mind was clear. The worst of her panic had blown away like industrial smogs before a strong wind, and she felt more than rational. She felt wholly sane again. She never would have believed it possible, and she found this evidence of the mind's tireless adaptability and almost insectile determination to survive a little spooky. "All of this, and I haven't even had my morning coffee," she thought. The image of coffee, black, and in her favorite cup with the blue flowers around its middle, made her lick her lips. It also made her think of the Today program. If her interior clock was right, Today would be coming on just about now. Men and women all over America, unhandcuffed for the most part, were sitting at kitchen tables, drinking juice and coffee, eating bagels and scrambled eggs, or maybe one of those cereals that are supposed to simultaneously soothe your heart and excite your bowels. They were watching Bryant Gumbel and Katie Couric yuck it up with Joe Garagiola. A little later, they would watch Willard Scott wish a couple of centenarians a happy day. There would be guests, one who would talk about something called the prime rate, something else called the Fed, one who would show viewers how they could keep their pet chows from chewing up their slippers, and one who would plug his latest movie. And none of them would realize that over in Western Maine there was an accident in progress, that one of their more or less loyal viewers was unable to tune in this morning because she was handcuffed to a bed less than 20 feet from her naked, dog-chewed, fly-blown husband. She turned her head to the right and looked up at the glass Gerald had set down carelessly on his side of the shelf shortly before the festivities had commenced. 5 years ago, she reflected, that glass probably wouldn't have been there. But as Gerald's nightly scotch consumption increased, so had his daily intake of all other liquids, mostly water. But he also drank tons of diet soda and iced tea. For Gerald, at least, the phrase "drinking problem" seemed to have been no euphemism, but the literal truth. Well, she thought drearily, if he did have a drinking problem, it's certainly cured now, isn't it? The glass was exactly where she had left it, of course, if her visitor of the previous night had not been a dream. Don't be silly. Of course it was a dream, the good wife said nervously. It must not have been thirsty. I'm going to get that glass, Jesse thought grimly. I'm also going to be extremely careful, in case there are more muscle cramps. Any questions? There weren't. And this time, getting the glass turned out to be a cakewalk, because it was a lot easier to reach. There was no need for the balancing act. She discovered an added bonus when she picked up her makeshift straw. As it dried, the blow-in card had curled up along the fold she had made. This strange geometrical construct looked like free-form origami and worked much more efficiently than it had the previous night. Getting the last of the water was even easier than getting the glass. And as Jessie listened to the malt shop crackle from the bottom of the glass, as her weird straw tried to suck up the last couple of drops, it occurred to her that she would have lost a lot less water to the coverlet if she had known she could cure the straw. Too late now, though, and no use crying over spilled water. The few sips did little more than wake up her thirst, but she would have to live with that. She put the glass back on the shelf, then laughed at herself. Habit was a tough little beast. Even under bizarre circumstances such as these, it was a tough little beast. She had risked cramping up all over again to return the empty glass to the shelf, instead of just bombing it over the side of the bed to shatter on the floor. And why? Because neatness counts, that's why. That was one of the things Sally Mayhoot had taught her little Tootsie, her little squeaky wheel who never got quite enough grease, and who was never able to let well enough alone. Her little Tootsie who had been willing to go to any lengths, including seducing her own father, to make sure that things would continue to go the way she wanted them to go. In the eye of her memory, Jessie saw the Sally Mayhoot she had seen so often back then, cheeks flushed with exasperation, lips pressed tightly together, hands rolled into fists and planted on her hips. And you would have believed it, too, Jessie said softly. Wouldn't you, you bitch? Not fair, part of her mind responded uneasily. Not fair, Jessie. Except it was fair, and she knew it. Sally had been a long way from the ideal mother, especially during those years when her marriage to Tom had been laboring along like an old car with dirt in the transmission. Her behavior during those years had often been paranoid and sometimes irrational. Will had, for some reason, been almost completely spared her tirades and suspicions, but she had sometimes frightened both of her daughters badly. That dark side was gone now. The letters Jessie got from Arizona were the banal, boring notes of an old lady who lived for Thursday night bingo and saw her child-rearing years as a peaceful, happy time. She apparently did not remember screaming at the top of her lungs that the next time Maddie forgot to wrap her used tampons in toilet paper before throwing them in the trash, she would kill her. Or the Sunday morning when she had, for no reason Jessie had ever been able to understand, stormed into Jessie's bedroom, thrown a pair of high-heeled shoes at her, and then stormed out again. Sometimes, when Jessie got her mother's notes and postcards, "All well here, sweetheart. Heard from Maddie," she writes so faithfully. "My appetite's a little better since it cooled off." Jessie felt an urge to snatch up the telephone and call her mother and scream, "Did you forget everything, Mom? Did you forget the day you threw the shoes at me? And broke my favorite vase, and I cried because I thought you must know, that he must have finally broken down and told you, even though it had been 3 years since the day of the eclipse by then? Did you forget how often you scared us with your screams and your tears? That's unfair, Jessie. Unfair and disloyal." Unfair it might be, but that did not make it untrue. If she had known what happened that day, the image of the woman in stocks recurred to Jessie again, there and gone almost too fast to be recognized, like subliminal advertising. The pinned hands, the hair covering the face like a penitent shroud, the little knot of pointing, contemptuous people, mostly women. Her mother might not have come right out and said so, but yes, she would have believed it was Jessie's fault, and she really might have thought it was a conscious seduction. It wasn't that much of a stretch from Squeaky Wheel to Lolita, was it? And the knowledge that something sexual had happened between her husband and her daughter very likely would have caused her to stop thinking about leaving and actually do it. Believed it? You bet she would have believed it. This time the voice of propriety didn't bother with even a token protest, and a sudden insight came to Jessie. Her father had grasped instantly what it had taken her almost 30 years to figure out. He had known the true facts, just as he had known about the odd acoustics of the living room dining room in the lake house. Her father had used her in more ways than one on that day. Jessie expected a flood of negative emotions at this sorry realization. She had, after all, been played for a sucker by the man whose primary jobs had been to love and protect her. No such flood came. Perhaps this was partly because she was still flying on endorphins, but she had an idea it had more to do with relief. No matter how rotten that business had been, she had finally been able to get outside it. Her dreams had not been dreams at all, not really, but thinly disguised recollections. Her chief emotions were amazement that she had held on to the secret for as long as she had, and a kind of uneasy perplexity. How many of the choices she had made since that day had been directly or indirectly influenced by what had happened during the final minute or so she had spent on her daddy's lap, looking at a vast round mole in the sky through 2 or 3 pieces of smoked glass? And was her current situation a result of what had happened during the eclipse? Oh, that's too much, she thought. If he'd raped me, maybe it would be different. But what happened on the deck that day was really just another accident, and not a very serious one at that. If you want to know what a serious accident is, Jess, look at the situation you're in here. I might as well blame old Mrs. Gillette for slapping my hand at that lawn party in her gazebo the summer I was 4, or a thought I had coming down the birth canal, or sins from some past life that still needed expiation. Besides, what he did to me on the deck wasn't anything compared to what he did to me in the bedroom. And there was no need to dream that part of it. It was right there, perfectly clear and perfectly accessible. When she looked up and saw her father standing in the bedroom doorway, her first instinctive gesture had been to cross her arms over her breasts. Then she saw the sad and guilty look on his face and dropped them again, although she felt heat rising in her cheeks and knew that her own face was turning the unlovely, patchy red that was her version of a maidenly blush. She had nothing to show up there. Well, almost nothing. But she still felt more naked than naked, and so embarrassed she could almost swear she felt her skin sizzling. She thought, suppose the others come back early. Suppose she walked in right now and saw me like this with my shirt off. Embarrassment became shame. Shame became terror. And still, as she shrugged into the blouse and began to button it, she felt another emotion underlying these. That feeling was anger. And it was not much different from the drilling anger she would feel years later, when she realized that Gerald knew she meant what she was saying, but was pretending he didn't. She was angry because she didn't deserve to feel ashamed and terrified. After all, he was the grown-up. He was the one who had left that funny-smelling crud on the back of her underpants. He was the one who was supposed to be ashamed, and that wasn't the way it was working. That wasn't the way it was working at all. By the time her blouse was buttoned and tucked into her shorts, the anger was gone, or, same difference, banished back to its cave. And what she kept seeing in her mind was her mother coming back early. It wouldn't matter that she was fully dressed again. The fact that something bad had happened was on their faces, just hanging out there, big as life and twice as ugly. She could see it on his face and feel it on her own. "Are you all right, Jessie?" he asked quietly. "Not feeling faint or anything?" "No." She tried to smile. but this time couldn't quite manage it. She felt a tear slip down one cheek and wiped it away quickly, guiltily, with the heel of her hand. "I'm sorry." His voice was trembling, and she was horrified to see tears standing in his eyes. Oh, this just got worse and worse and worse. "I'm so sorry." He turned abruptly, ducked into the bathroom, grabbed a towel off the rack, and wiped his face with it. While he did this, Jesse thought fast and hard. "Daddy?" He looked at her over the towel. The tears in his eyes were gone. If she hadn't known better, she would have sworn they had never been there at all. The question almost stuck in her throat, but it had to be asked. Had to be. Do we have to tell Mom about it?" He took a long, sighing, trembling breath. She waited, her heart in her mouth, and when he said, "I think we have to, don't you?" it sank all the way to her feet. She crossed the room to him, staggering a little. Her legs seemed to have no feeling in them at all, and wrapped her arms around him. "Please, Daddy, don't. Please don't tell. Please don't. Please." Her voice blurred, collapsed into sobs, and she pressed her face against his bare chest. After a moment, he slipped his arms around her, this time in his old fatherly way. "I hate to," he said, "because things have been pretty tense between the two of us just lately, hun. I'd be surprised if you didn't know that, actually. A thing like this could make them a lot worse. She hasn't been very, well, very affectionate lately, and that was most of the problem today. A man has certain needs. You'll understand about that someday. But if she finds out, she'll say it was my fault." "Oh, no, I don't think so," Tom said. But his tone was surprised, considering, and to Jesse as dreadful as a death sentence. "No, I'm sure, well, fairly sure that she..." She looked up at him, her eyes streaming and red. "Please don't tell her, Daddy. Please don't. Please don't." He kissed her brow. "But, Jesse, I have to. We have to."
"Why? Why, Daddy?"
"Because..." Jesse shifted a little. The chains jingled. The cuffs themselves rattled on the bedposts. The light was now streaming in through the east windows. "Because you couldn't keep it a secret," she said dully. "Because if it's going to come out, Jesse, it's better for both of us that it should come out now, rather than a week from now, or a month from now, or a year from now, even 10 years from now." How well he had manipulated her. First the apology, then the tears, and finally the hat trick, turning his problem into her problem. "Brer Fox, Brer Fox, whatever else y'all do, don't throw me in that briar patch." Until finally she had been swearing to him that she would keep the secret forever, that torturers couldn't drag it out of her with tongs and hot coals. She could, in fact, remember promising him something just like that through a rain of hot, frightened tears. Finally, he had stopped shaking his head and had only looked across the room with his eyes narrowed and his lips pressed tightly together. This she saw in the mirror, as he almost surely knew she would. "You could never tell anyone," he'd said at last. And Jesse remembered the swooning relief she'd felt at those words. What he was saying was less important than the tone in which he was saying it. Jesse had heard that tone a good many times before, and knew it drove her mother crazy, that she, Jesse,
could cause him to speak that way more often than Sally herself. "I'm changing my mind," it said. "I'm doing it against my better judgment, but I am changing it. I'm swinging around to your side." No, she had agreed. Her voice was wavery, and she had to keep gulping back tears. "I wouldn't tell, Daddy. Not ever. Not just your mother," he said, "but anyone, ever. That's a big responsibility for a little girl, Punkin. You might be tempted. For instance, if you were studying with Carolyn Klein or Tammy Ho after school, and one of them told you a secret of hers, you might want to tell them? Never, never, never!" And he must have seen the truth of it on her face. The thought of either Carolyn or Tammy finding out that her father had touched her had filled Jesse with horror. Satisfied on that score, he had pushed on to what she now guessed must have been his chief concern. "Or your sister." He pushed her back from him and looked sternly down into her face for a long moment. "There could come a time, you see, when you wanted to tell her."
"Daddy, no, I'd never."
He gave her a gentle shake. "Keep quiet and let me finish, Punkin. You two are close, I know that. And I know that girls sometimes feel an urge to share things they ordinarily wouldn't tell. If you felt that way with Maddie, could you still manage to keep quiet?"
"Yes!"
In her desperate need to convince him, she had begun to cry once more. Of course, it was more likely that she would tell Maddie, if there was anyone else in the world to whom she might one day confide such a desperate secret. It would be her big sister, except for one thing. Maddie and Sally shared the same sort of closeness Jesse and Tom had shared, and if Jesse ever told her sister about what had happened on the deck, the chances that their mother would know before the day was out were very good. Given that insight, Jesse thought she could quite easily withstand the temptation to tell Maddie. "Are you really sure?" he had asked doubtfully.
"Yes, really."
He'd begun to shake his head again in a regretful way that terrified her all over again. "I just think, Punkin, that it might be better to get it out in the open right away. Take our medicine. I mean, she can't kill us." Jesse, however, had heard her anger when Daddy had asked that she be excused from the trip to Mount Washington. And anger wasn't all. She didn't like to think of it, but at this point she could not afford the luxury of denial. There had been jealousy, and something very close to hatred in her mother's voice as well. A vision, momentary but of paralyzing clarity, had come to Jesse as she stood with her father in the bedroom doorway, trying to persuade him to hold his peace. The two of them cast out on the road like Hansel and Gretel, homeless, tramping back and forth across America. And sleeping together, of course. Sleeping together at night. She had broken down utterly then, weeping hysterically, begging him not to tell, promising him she would be a good girl forever and ever if he just wouldn't tell. He had let her cry until he must have felt the moment was exactly right, and then he said gravely, "You know, you've got an awful lot of power for a little girl, Punkin." She had looked up at him, cheeks wet and eyes full of fresh hope. He nodded slowly, then began to dry her tears with a towel he had used on his own face. "I've never been able to refuse you anything that you really wanted, and I can't this time either. We'll try it your way." She threw herself into his arms and began covering his face with kisses. Somewhere far back in her mind, she had been afraid this might get him going, start trouble again. But her gratitude had completely overwhelmed such caution, and there had been no trouble.
"Thank you. Thank you, Daddy. Thank you."
He had taken her by the shoulders and held her at arm's length again, smiling instead of grave this time. But that sadness had still been on his face, and now, almost 30 years later, Jesse didn't think that expression had been part of the show. The sadness had been real, and that somehow made the terrible thing he had done worse instead of better. "I guess we have a bargain," he said. "I say nothing, you say nothing. Right? Right. Not to anyone else. Not even to each other. Forever and ever, amen. When we walk out of this room, Jess, it never happened. Okay?" She had agreed at once, but at the same time the memory of that smell had recurred to her, and she had known there was at least one question she had to ask him before it never happened. "And there's something I need to say once more. I need to say I'm sorry, Jess. I did a shabby, shameful thing." He had looked away when he had said that, she remembered. All the time he had been deliberately driving her into hysterics of guilt and fear and impending doom. All the time he had been making sure she would never say anything by threatening to tell everything. He had looked right at her. When he offered that last apology, however, his gaze had shifted to the crayon designs on the sheets which divided the room. This memory filled her with something that felt simultaneously like grief and rage. He had been able to face her with his lies. It was the truth which had finally caused him to look away. She remembered opening her mouth to tell him he didn't have to say that, then closing it again, partly because she was afraid anything she said might cause him to change his mind back again, but mostly because, even at 10, she had realized she had the right to an apology. "Sally's been cold. It's the truth. But as an excuse, it's pretty sad shit. I don't have the slightest idea what came over me." He had laughed a little, still not looking at her. "Maybe it was the eclipse. If it was, thank God we'll never see another one." Then, as if speaking to himself, "Christ, if we keep our mouths shut and then she finds out anyway later on." Jessie had put her head against his chest and said, "She won't. I'll never tell, Daddy." She paused, then added, "What could I tell anyway?" "That's right," he smiled, "because nothing happened. And I couldn't be..." She had looked up, hoping he might tell her what she needed to know without her asking, but he only looked back at her, eyebrows raised in a silent interrogative. The smile had been replaced by a wary, waiting expression. "I couldn't be pregnant then?" she blurted. He winced, and then his face had tensed as he worked to suppress some strong emotion. Horror or grief, she'd thought then. It was only all these years later that it occurred to her that what he might actually have been trying to control was a burst of wild, relieved laughter. At last he had gotten himself under control and kissed the tip of her nose. "No, honey, of course not. The thing that makes women pregnant didn't happen. Nothing like that happened. I was wrestling with you a little, that's all." "And you goosed me." She remembered saying that very clearly now. "You goosed me, that's what you did." He had smiled. "Yep, that's close enough. You're just as fine as ever, Punkin. Now what do you think? Does that close the subject?" She had nodded. "Nothing like this is ever going to happen again. You know that, don't you?" She nodded again, but her own smile had faltered. What he was saying should have relieved her, and it did, a little. But something in the gravity of his words and the sorrow on his face had almost sparked her panic again. She remembered taking his hands and squeezing them as hard as she could. "You love me, though, don't you, Daddy?" "You still love me, right?" He had nodded and told her he loved her more than ever. "Then hug me. Hug me hard." And he did. But now Jessie could remember something else. His lower body had not touched hers. "Not then and never again," Jessie thought. "Not that I remember, anyway. Even when I graduated from college, the only other time I saw him cry over me, he gave me one of those funny old maid hugs, the kind you do with your ass pooching out so there isn't even a chance you can bump crotches with the person you're hugging. Poor, poor man. I wonder if any of the people he did business with over the years ever saw him as rattled as I saw him on the day of the eclipse. All that pain, and over what? A sexual accident, about as serious as a stubbed toe. Jesus, what a life it is. What a fucking life. She began to pump her arm slowly up and down again, almost without being aware of it, only wanting to keep the blood flowing into her hands, wrists, and forearms. She guessed it was probably 8 o'clock by now, or almost. She had been chained to this bed for 18 hours. Incredible, but true. Ruth Neary's voice spoke up so suddenly that it made her jump. It was filled with disgusted wonder. You're still making excuses for him, aren't you? Still letting him off the hook and blaming yourself after all these years. Even now. Amazing. Quit it, she said hoarsely. None of that has the slightest goddamn thing to do with the mess I'm in now. What a piece of work you are, Jesse. And even if it did, she went on, raising her voice slightly, even if it did, it doesn't have the slightest goddamn thing to do with getting out of the mess I'm in now, so just give it a rest. You weren't Lolita, Jesse, no matter what he might have made you think. You were about 9 country miles from Lolita. Jesse refused to reply. Ruth went one better. She refused to shut up. If you still think your dear old daddy was a parfait gentil knight who spent most of his time shielding you from the fire-breathing mommy dragon, you'd better think again. Shut up. Jesse began to pump her arms up and down faster. The chains jingled. The cuffs rattled. Shut up, you're horrible. He planned it, Jesse. Don't you understand? It wasn't just some spur-of-the-moment thing, a sex-starved father copping a quick feel. He planned it. You lie, Jesse snarled. Sweat rolled down from her temples in large, clear droplets. Do I? Well, ask yourself this. Whose idea was it for you to wear the sundress? The one that was both too small and too tight? Who knew you'd be listening and admiring while he maneuvered around your mother? Who had his hands on your tits the night before? And who was wearing gym shorts and nothing else on the day of? Suddenly she imagined Bryant Gumbel in the room with her, natty in a 3-piece suit and gold wrist chain, standing here by the bed while a guy with a minicam stood beside him, panning slowly up her almost naked body before focusing on her sweaty, blotchy face. Bryant Gumbel doing a live remote with the incredible handcuffed woman, leaning forward with a microphone to ask her, "When did you first realize your father might have had the hots for you, Jesse?" Jesse stopped pumping her arms and closed her eyes. There was a closed, stubborn look on her face. No more, she thought. I guess I can live with the voices of Ruth and the good wife if I have to. Even with the assorted UFOs who chip in their 2 cents worth every once in a while. But I draw the line at doing a live interview with Bryant Gumbel while dressed in nothing but a pair of pea-stained panties. Even in my imagination, I draw the line at that. Just tell me one thing, Jesse, another voice said. No UFO here. It was the voice of Nora Callaghan. One thing, and we'll consider the subject closed, at least for now. And probably forever. Okay? Jesse was silent, waiting, wary. When you finally lost your temper yesterday afternoon, when you finally kicked out, who were you kicking at? Was it Gerald? Of course it was Gerald, she began, and then broke off as a single image, perfectly clear, filled her mind. It was the white string of drool which had been hanging from Gerald's chin. She saw it elongate, saw it fall to her midriff just above the navel. Only a little spit, that was all. No big deal after all the years and all the passionate kisses with their mouths open and their tongues dueling. She and Gerald had swapped a fair amount of lubrication, and the only price they'd ever paid was a few shared colds. No big deal, that was, until today, when he'd refused to let her go when she wanted, needed to be let go. No big deal until she'd smelled that flat, sad mineral smell, the one she associated with the well water at Dark Score, and with the lake itself on hot summer days. Days like July 20th, 1963, for instance. She had seen spit. She had thought spunk. No, that's not true, she thought. But she didn't need to summon Ruth to play devil's advocate this time. She knew it was true. It's his goddamn spunk. That had been her exact thought. And after that, she had ceased thinking altogether, at least for a while. Instead of thinking, she had launched that reflexive countering movement, driving one foot into his stomach and the other into his balls. Not spit, but spunk. Not some new revulsion at Gerald's game, but that old stinking horror suddenly surfacing like a sea monster. Jessie glanced at the huddled, mutilated body of her husband. Tears pricked her eyes for a moment, and then the sensation passed. She had an idea that the survival department had decided tears were a luxury she could not afford, at least not for the time being. Still, she was sorry. Sorry Gerald was dead, yes, of course. But even sorrier she was here in this situation. Her eyes shifted to thin air a little above Gerald, and Jessie produced a shabby, pained smile. I guess that's all I've got to say right now, Bryant. Give my best to Willard and Katie. And by the way, would you mind unlocking these handcuffs before you go? I'd really appreciate it. Bryant didn't answer. Jessie wasn't all that surprised. If you're going to live through this experience, Jess, I suggest you stop rehashing the past and start deciding what you're going to do with the future, starting with the next 10 minutes or so. I don't think the dying of thirst on this bed would be very pleasant, do you? No, not very pleasant. And she thought that thirst would be far from the worst of it. Crucifixion had been in the back of her mind almost since she'd awakened, floating up and down like some nasty drowned thing which is just a little too waterlogged to come all the way to the surface. She had read an article about this charming old method of torture and execution for a college history class, and had been surprised to learn that the old nails through the hands and feet trick was only the beginning. Like magazine subscriptions and pocket calculators, crucifixion was the gift that kept on giving. The real hardships began with the cramps and muscle spasms. Jessie reluctantly recognized that the pain she had suffered so far, even the paralyzing Charlie horse which had put an end to her first panic attack, were only tweaks compared to the ones which were waiting. They would rack her arms, diaphragm, and abdomen, growing steadily worse, more frequent, and more widespread as the day passed. Numbness would eventually begin to creep into her extremities, no matter how hard she worked to keep the blood flowing. But numbness would bring no relief. By then, she would almost certainly have begun suffering excruciating chest and stomach cramps. There were no nails in her hands and feet, and she was lying down instead of hanging from a cross at the side of the road, like one of the defeated gladiators in Spartacus. But those variations might only draw out her agony. So what are you doing right now, while you're still pretty much free of pain and able to think? Whatever I can, she croaked. So why don't you just shut up and let me think for a minute? Go ahead. Be my guest. She would start with the most obvious solution and work her way down from there, if she had to. And what was the most obvious solution? The keys, of course. They were still lying on top of the bureau where he had left them. Two keys, but both exactly the same. Gerald, who could be almost endearingly corny, had often referred to them as the primary and the backup. Jessie had clearly heard those capital letters in her husband's voice. Suppose, just for the sake of argument, she could somehow slide the bed across the room to the bureau. Would she be able to actually get hold of one of those keys and put it to use? Jessie reluctantly realized that there were two questions there, not one. She supposed she might be able to pick up one of the keys in her teeth, but then what? She still wouldn't be able to get it into the lock. Her experience with a water glass suggested there was going to be a gap no matter how much she stretched. Okay. Scratch the keys. Descend to the next rung on the ladder of probability. What might that be? She thought about it for almost 5 minutes without success, turning it around and around in her mind like the sides of a Rubik's Cube, pumping her arms up and down as she did so. At some point during her ruminations, her eyes wandered to the phone sitting on the low table by the east window. She had dismissed it earlier as being in another universe, but perhaps she had been too hasty. The table, after all, was closer than the bureau, and the phone was a lot bigger than a handcuff key. If she could move the bed over to the telephone table, might she not be able to lift the receiver off the cradle with her foot? And if she could do that, maybe she could use her big toe to push the operator button at the bottom, between the keys marked star and pound. It sounded like some crazy sort of vaudeville act, but push the button, wait, then start screaming my head off. Yes, and half an hour later, either the big blue Medcu van from Norway or the big orange one marked Castle County Rescue would turn up and trundle her off to safety. A crazy idea, all right, but so was turning a magazine subscription card into a straw. It could work, crazy or not, that was the point. It certainly had more potential than somehow pushing the bed all the way across the room and then trying to find a way to get one of the keys into one of the handcuff locks. There was one big problem with the idea, however. She would somehow have to find a way to move the bed to the right, and that was a heavy proposition. She guessed that with its mahogany head and footboards, it had to weigh at least 300 pounds, and that estimate might be conservative. But you can at least try it, babe, and you might get a big surprise. The floor has been waxed since Labor Day, remember? If a stray dog with its ribs sticking out can move your husband, maybe you can move this bed. You haven't got anything to lose by trying, do you? A good point. Jessie worked her legs toward the left side of the bed, shifting her back and shoulders patiently to the right as she did so. When she got as far as she was going to, using that method, she pivoted on her left hip. Her feet went over the side. And suddenly her legs and torso were not just moving to the left, but sliding to the left, like an avalanche trying to happen. A horrible cramp jig-jagged up her left side, as her body stretched in ways it hadn't been meant to, even under the best of conditions. It felt as if someone had given her a fast, harsh scrape with a hot poker. The short chain between the right-hand set of cuffs yanked taut, and for a moment the news from her left side was blotted out by a fresh agony pulsing out of her right arm and shoulder. It felt as if someone were trying to twist that arm completely off. "Now I know what a turkey drumstick feels like," she thought. Her left heel thumped onto the floor. Her right hung 3 inches above it. Her body was twisted unnaturally to the left, with her right arm cast strenuously back behind her in a kind of frozen wave. The taut chain gleamed heartlessly above its rubber sleeve in the early morning sun. Jessie was suddenly sure she was going to die in this position, with her left side and right arm screaming. She would have to lie here, gradually growing numb as her flagging heart lost the battle to pump blood to all parts of her stretched and twisted body. Panic overtook her again, and she howled for help, forgetting there was no one in the neighborhood but one raggedy-ass stray with a belly full of lawyer. She flailed frantically for the bedpost with her right hand, but she had slid just a little too far. The dark-stained mahogany was half an inch beyond the tips of her straining fingers.
"Help! Please! Help! Help!"
No answer. The only sounds in this silent, sunny bedroom were her sounds. Hoarse, screaming voice, rasping breath, pounding heart. No one here but her. And unless she was able to get back onto the bed, she was going to die like a woman hung on a meat hook. Nor was the situation done getting worse. Her butt was still sliding toward the edge of the bed, pulling her right arm steadily backward at an angle which was becoming more and more extreme. Without thinking about it or planning it, unless the body, goaded by pain, sometimes thinks for itself, Jessie braced her bare left heel on the floor and shoved backward with all her might. It was the only brace point remaining to her painfully slewed body, and the maneuver worked. Her lower body arched, the chain between the cuffs binding her right hand grew slack, and she seized the bedpost with the panicky zeal of a drowning woman seizing a life ring. She used it to yank herself backward, ignoring the scream of her back and biceps. When her feet were up again, she paddled frantically back from the edge, as if she had dipped into a swimming pool filled with baby sharks and had noticed just in time to save her toes. At last she regained her former slumped sitting position against the crossboards, arms outstretched, the small of her back resting on the sweat-soaked pillow in its badly wrinkled cotton case. She let her head loll back against the mahogany slats, breathing rapidly, her bare breasts oiled with sweat she couldn't afford to lose. She closed her eyes and laughed weakly. Say, that was pretty exciting, wasn't it, Jesse? I think it's the fastest and hardest your heart has beat since 1985, when you came within a Christmas party kiss or so of going to bed with Tommy Del Guidacci. Nothing to lose by trying, isn't that what you thought? Well, now you know better. Yes, and she knew something else as well. Oh, and what's that, Toots? I know that fucking phone is out of reach, she said. Yes, indeed. When she had pushed off with her left heel just now, she'd gotten all of her 125 pounds into it. She had shoved with all the enthusiasm of a total ass-freezing panic. The bed hadn't moved an iota, and now that she had a chance to think about it, she was glad it hadn't. If it had jigged to the right, she would still be hanging off it. And even if she had been able to push it all the way across to the telephone table that way, why, I'd have been hanging over the wrong fucking side, she said, half laughing and half sobbing. Jesus, somebody shoot me. Doesn't look good. One of the UFO voices, one she definitely could have done without, told her. In fact, it sort of looks like the Jesse Burlingame show just got its cancellation notice. Pick another choice, she said huskily. I don't like that one. There aren't any others. There weren't that many to begin with, and you've researched them all. She closed her eyes again, and for the second time since this nightmare began, she saw the playground behind the old Falmouth Grammar School on Central Avenue. Only this time it wasn't the image of two little girls balancing on a seesaw that filled her mind. Instead, she saw one little boy, her brother Will, skinning the cat on the monkey bars. She opened her eyes, slumped down, and bent her head to look more closely at the headboard. Skinning the cat meant hanging from the bar, then curling your legs up and over your shoulders. You finished with a quick little pivot which enabled you to land on your feet again. Will had been so adept at this neat and economical movement that it had looked to Jesse as if he was turning somersaults inside his own hands. Suppose I could do that. Just skin the cat right over the top of this goddamn headboard. Swing over the top and land on my feet, she whispered. For several moments, this seemed dangerous but feasible. She would have to move the bed out from the wall, of course. You couldn't skin the cat if you didn't have a place to land. But she had an idea that she could manage that. Once the bed shelf was removed, and it would be easy to knock it off its support brackets, unanchored as it was, she would do a back-over roll and plant her bare feet against the wall above the top of the headboard. She hadn't been able to move the bed sideways, but with the wall to push against. Same weight, 10 times the leverage, she muttered. Modern physics at its finest. She was reaching for the shelf with her left hand, meaning to tip it up and off the L-brackets, when she took another good look at Gerald's goddamn police handcuffs with their suicidally short chains. If he had clipped them onto the bedposts a little higher, between the first and second crossboards, say, she might have chanced it. The maneuver would probably have resulted in a pair of broken wrists, but she had reached a point where a pair of broken wrists seemed an entirely acceptable price to pay for escape. After all, they would heal, wouldn't they? Instead of between the first and second crossboards, however, the cuffs were attached between the second and third, and that was just a little too far down. Any attempt to skin the cat over the headboard would do more than break her wrists. It would result in a pair of shoulders not just dislocated, but actually ripped out of their sockets by her descending weight. And try moving this goddamn bed anywhere with a pair of broken wrists and two dislocated shoulders. Sound like fun? No, she said huskily. Not too much. Let's cut through it, Jess. You're stuck here. You can call me the voice of despair if it makes you feel better, or if it helps you to hold on to your sanity for a little while longer. God knows I'm all for sanity. But what I really am is the voice of truth. And the truth of this situation is that you're stuck here. Jessie turned her head sharply to one side, not wanting to hear this self-styled voice of truth, and found she was no more able to shut it out than she had been able to shut out the other ones. Those are real handcuffs you're wearing, not the cute little bondage numbers with the padding inside the wristlets and a hidden escape lever you can push if someone gets carried away and starts going a little too far. You're for real locked up. And you don't happen to be either a faker from the mysterious East, capable of twisting your body up like a pretzel, or an escape artist like Harry Houdini or David Copperfield. I'm just telling it the way I see it, okay? And the way I see it, you're toast. She suddenly remembered what had happened after her father had left her bedroom on the day of the eclipse. How she had thrown herself on her bed and cried until it seemed her heart would either break or melt, or maybe just seize up for good. And now, as her mouth began to tremble, she looked remarkably as she had then, tired, confused, frightened, and lost. That last most of all. Jessie began to cry, but after the first few tears her eyes would produce no more. Stricter rationing measures had apparently gone into effect. She cried anyway, tearlessly, her sobs as dry as sandpaper in her throat.
In New York City, the regulars of the Today program had signed off for another day. On the NBC affiliate, which served southern and western Maine, they were replaced first by a local chat show. A large, motherly woman in a gingham apron showed how easy it was to slow-cook beans in your crock pot. Then by a game show where celebrities cracked jokes and contestants uttered loud, orgasmic screams when they won cars and boats and bright red dirt devil vacuum cleaners. In the Burlingame home on scenic Kashwakamak Lake, the new widow dozed uneasily in her restraints and then began to dream once more. It was a nightmare, one made more vivid and somehow more persuasive by the very shallowness of the dreamer's sleep. In it, Jessie was lying in the dark again, and a man, or a man-like thing, was once more standing across from her in the corner of the room. The man wasn't her father. The man wasn't her husband. The man was a stranger, the stranger, the one who haunts all our sickest, most paranoid imaginings and deepest fears. It was the face of a creature Nora Callaghan, with her good advice and sweet practical nature, had never taken into account. This black being could not be conjured away by anything with an ology suffix. It was a cosmic wild card. "But you do know me," the stranger with a long white face said. It bent down and grasped the handle of its bag. Jessie noted, with no surprise at all, that the handle was a jawbone, and the bag itself was made of human skin. The stranger picked it up, flicked the clasps, and opened the lid. Again she saw the bones and the jewels. Again it reached its hand into the tangle and began to move it in slow circles, producing those ghastly clickings and clackings and rappings and tappings. "No, I don't," she said. "I don't know who you are. I don't. I don't. I don't. I'm death, of course. And I'll be back tonight. Only tonight I think I'll do a little more than just stand in the corner. Tonight I think I'll jump out at you, just like this." It leapt forward, dropping the case. Bones and pendants and rings and necklaces spilled out toward where Gerald lay sprawled with his mutilated arm pointing toward the hallway door,
and shooting out its hands. She saw its fingers ended in dark, filthy nails, so long they were really claws. And then she shook herself awake with a gasp and a jerk, the handcuff chain swinging and jingling as she made warding-off gestures with her hands. She was whispering the word no over and over again in a slurry monotone. It was a dream. Stop it, Jesse. It was just a dream. She slowly lowered her hands, letting them dangle limply against the cuffs once more. Of course it had been. Just a variation of the bad dream she'd had last night. It had been realistic, though. Jesus, yes. Far worse, when you got right down to it, than the one of the croquet party, or even the one in which she had recalled the furtive and unhappy interlude with her father during the eclipse. It was passing strange that she had spent so much time this morning thinking about those dreams, and so little thinking about the far scarier one. In fact, she really hadn't thought of the creature with the weirdly long arms and the gruesome souvenir case at all until she'd dozed off and dreamed of him just now. A snatch of song occurred to her, something from the latter psychedelic age. Some people call me the space cowboy, yeah. Some call me the gangster of love. Jesse shuddered. The space cowboy. That was somehow just right. An outsider. Someone who had nothing to do with anything. A cosmic wild card. A stranger. Jesse whispered, and suddenly remembered the way its cheeks had wrinkled when it began to grin. And once that detail had fallen into place, others began falling into place around it. The gold teeth twinkling far back in the grinning mouth, the pouty, poochy lips, the livid brow and the blade of nose. And there was the case, of course, like something you might expect to see banging against a traveling salesman's leg as he ran to catch his train. Stop it, Jesse! Stop giving yourself the horrors! Don't you have enough problems without worrying about the boogeyman? She most certainly did. But she found that now that she had begun thinking about the dream, she couldn't seem to stop. Worse than that was the fact that the more she thought about it, the less dreamlike it became. What if I was awake? She thought suddenly. And once the idea was articulated, she was horrified to discover some part of her had believed just that all along. It had only been waiting for the rest of her to catch up. No, oh no, it was just a dream, that's all. But what if it wasn't? What if it wasn't? Death, the white-faced stranger agreed. It was death you saw. I'll be back tonight, Jesse. And tomorrow night I'll have your rings in my case with the rest of my pretty things. My souvenirs. Jesse realized she was shivering violently, as if she had caught a chill. Her wide eyes looked helplessly into the empty corner where the space cowboy, gangster of love, had stood. The corner which was now bright with morning sunshine, but would be dark with tangles of shadow tonight. Knots of goose flesh had begun to pop up on her skin. The inescapable truth came again. She was probably going to die here. Eventually, someone will find you, Jesse. But it might take a long time. The first assumption will be that the two of you are off on some wild romantic fling. Why not? Didn't you and Gerald give every outward appearance of second-decade wedded bliss? It was only the two of you who knew that, at the end, Gerald could get it up with any reliability, only if you were handcuffed to the bed. Sort of makes you wonder if someone played a few little games with him on the day of the eclipse, doesn't it? Stop talking, she muttered. All of you, stop talking. But sooner or later, people will get nervous and start hunting for you. It'll probably be Gerald's colleagues who actually get the wheels turning, don't you think? I mean, there are a couple of women in Portland you call friends, but you've never really let them inside your life, have you? Acquaintances is really all they are. Ladies to have tea with and swap catalogs with. None of them are going to worry much if you drop out of sight for a week or 10 days. But Gerald will have appointments,
And when he doesn't show up by Friday noon, I think some of his bullpen buddies will start making phone calls and asking questions. Yes, that's the way it will probably start. But I think it'll probably be the caretaker who actually discovers the bodies, don't you? I bet he'll turn his face away while he's throwing the spare blanket from the closet shelf over you, Jesse. He won't want to see the way your fingers stick out of the handcuffs, as stiff as pencils and as white as candles. He won't want to look at your frozen mouth, or the foam long since dried to scales on your lips. Most of all, he won't want to look at the expression of horror in your eyes. So he'll shift his own eyes to the side while he covers you up. Jessie moved her head from side to side in a slow, hopeless gesture of negation. Bill will call the police, and they'll show up with a forensic unit and the county coroner. They'll all stand around the bed smoking cigars. Doug Rowe, undoubtedly wearing his awful white trench coat, will be standing outside with his film crew. And when the coroner pulls off the blanket, they'll wince. Yes, I think even the most hardened of them is going to wince a little. And some of them may actually leave the room. Their buddies will razz them about it later. And the ones who stay will nod and tell each other that the person on the bed died hard. You only have to look at her to see that, they'll say. But they won't know the half of it. They won't know that the real reason your eyes are staring and your mouth is frozen in a scream is because of what you saw at the end. What you saw coming out of the dark. Your father may have been your first lover, Jesse, but your last is going to be the stranger with the long white face and the traveling bag made out of human skin. Oh, please, can't you quit? Jesse moaned. No more voices, please. No more voices. But this voice wouldn't stop. Wouldn't even acknowledge her. It just went on and on, whispering directly into her mind from some place far down on her brainstem. Listening to it was like having a mud-slimed piece of silk drawn lightly back and forth across her face. They'll take you to Augusta, and the state medical examiner will cut you open so he can inventory your guts. That's the rule in cases of unattended or questionable death, and yours is going to be both. He'll have a peek at what's left of your last meal, the salami and cheese sub from Amato's in Gorham, and take a little section of brain to look at under his microscope. And in the end, he'll call it death by misadventure. The lady and the gentleman were playing an ordinarily harmless game, he'll say. Only the gentleman had the bad taste to have a heart attack at the critical moment, and the woman was left to... Well, it's best not to go into it. Best not to even think about it any more than is strictly necessary. Suffice it to say that the lady died hard. You only have to look at her to see that. That's how it's going to shake out, Jess. Maybe someone will notice your wedding ring is gone, but they won't hunt for it long, if at all. Nor will the ME notice that one of your bones, an unimportant one, the third phalange in your right foot, let's say, is gone. But we'll know, won't we, Jesse? In fact, we know already. We'll know that it took them. The cosmic stranger. The space cowboy. We'll know. Jesse drove her head back against the headboard hard enough to send a school of big white fish exploding across her field of vision. It hurt. It hurt a lot. But the mind voice cut out like a radio in a power failure, and that made it worth it. There, she said. And if you start up again, I'll do that again. I'm not kidding, either. I'm tired of listening to... Now it was her own voice, speaking unselfconsciously aloud in the empty room, that cut out like a radio in a power failure. As the spots before her eyes began to fade, she saw the morning sunlight glinting off something which lay about 18 inches beyond Gerald's outstretched hand. It was a small, white object with a narrow thread of gold twisting up through the center, making it look like a yin-yang symbol. At first, Jesse thought it was a finger ring, but it was really too small for that. Not a finger ring, but a pearl earring. It had dropped to the floor while her visitor had been stirring the contents of its case around, showing them off to her. "No," she whispered. "No, not possible." But it was there, glinting in the morning sunshine and every bit as real as the dead man who seemed almost to be pointing at it. A pearl earring spliced with a delicate glint of gold. "It's one of mine. It spilled out of my jewelry box. It's been there since the summer, and I'm just noticing it now." Except that she only owned one set of pearl earrings. They had no gold highlights, and they were back in Portland anyway. Except that the men from Skip's had been in to wax the floors the week after Labor Day, and if there had been an earring left on the floor, one of them would have picked it up and put it either on the dresser or in his own pocket. And there was something else, too. It was just beyond the orphan earring. Even if there was, I wouldn't look at it. Except she couldn't not look at it. Her eyes moved past the earring of their own accord and fixed on the floor just inside the door to the front hall. There was a little spot of dried blood there, but it wasn't the blood which had caught her attention. The blood belonged to Gerald. The blood was all right. It was the footprint beside it that worried her. If there was a track there, it was there before. Much as Jessie wished she could believe that, the track had not been there before. Yesterday there hadn't been a single scuff on this floor, let alone a foot track. Nor had she or Gerald left the one she was looking at. That was a shoe-shaped ring of dried mud, probably from the overgrown path that meandered along the shore of the lake for a mile or so, before cutting back into the woods and heading south toward Motton. Someone had been in the bedroom with her last night, after all, it seemed. As this thought settled inexorably into Jessie's overstrained mind, she began to scream. Outside, on the back stoop, the stray lifted its scuffed, scratched muzzle from its paws for a moment. It cocked its good ear. Then it lost interest and lowered its head again. It wasn't as if the noise were being made by anything dangerous, after all. It was only the bitchmaster. Besides, the smell of the dark thing which had come in the night was on her now. It was one the stray was very familiar with. It was the smell of death. The former prince closed its eyes and went back to sleep. At last she began to get herself under some kind of control again. She did this, absurdly enough, by reciting Nora Callaghan's little mantra. "One is for feet," she said, her dry voice cracking and wavering in the empty bedroom. 10 little toes, cute little piggies, all in a row. 2 is for legs, lovely and long. 3 is my sex, where everything's wrong." She pushed steadily on, reciting the couplets she could remember, skipping the ones she couldn't, keeping her eyes closed. She went through the whole thing 6 times. She was aware that her heartbeat was slowing down, and the worst of her terror was once more draining away. But she had no conscious awareness of the radical change she had made in at least one of Nora's jangly little couplets. After the 6th repetition, she opened her eyes and looked about the room like a woman who has just awakened from a short, restful nap. She avoided the corner by the bureau, however. She didn't want to look at the earring again, and she most certainly didn't want to look at the footprint. "Jessie." The voice was very soft, very tentative. Jessie thought it was the voice of the goodwife, now drained of both its shrill ardor and its feverish denial. "Jessie, can I say something?" "No," she responded immediately in her harsh, dust-in-the-cracks voice. "Take a hike. I want to be done with all you bitches. Please, Jessie, please listen to me. She closed her eyes and found she could actually see that part of her personality she had come to call Goody Burlingame. Goody was still in the stocks, but now she raised her head, an act that couldn't have been easy with a cruel wooden restraint pressing into the back of her neck. Her hair fell away from her face momentarily, and Jessie was surprised to see not the good wife, but a young girl. "Yeah, but she's still me," Jessie thought, and almost laughed. If this wasn't a case of comic book psychology, she didn't know what was. She had just been thinking about Nora, and one of Nora's favorite hobby horses was about how people had to care for the child inside. Nora claimed that the most common reason for unhappiness was failure to feed and nurture that interior child. Jessie had nodded solemnly at all this, keeping her belief that the idea was mostly sentimental Aquarian New Age slop to herself. She had liked Nora, after all, and although she thought Nora had held on to a few too many sets of mental love beads from the late 60s and early 70s, she was clearly seeing Nora's child inside now, and that seemed perfectly all right. Jessie supposed that the concept might even have some symbolic validity. And under the circumstances, the stocks made a hell of an apt image, didn't they? The person in them was the goodwife in waiting, the Ruth in waiting, the Jessie in waiting. She was the little girl her father had called Pumpkin. "So talk," Jessie said. Her eyes were still closed, and a combination of stress, hunger, and thirst had combined to make the vision of the girl in the stocks almost exquisitely real. Now she could see the words, "For sexual enticement," written on a sheet of vellum nailed above the girl's head. The words were written in candy pink peppermint yum-yum lipstick, of course. Nor was her imagination done yet. Next to Pumpkin was another set of stocks, with another girl in them. This one was perhaps 17, and fat. Her complexion was blotched with pimples. Behind the prisoners, a town common appeared, and after a moment Jessie could see a few cows grazing on it. Someone was ringing a bell, over the next hill it sounded like, with monotonous regularity, as if the ringer intended to keep it up all day, or at least until the cows came home. "You're losing your mind, Jess," she thought faintly, and she supposed this was true, but unimportant. She might even count it among her blessings before much longer. She pushed the thought away and turned her attention back to the girl in the stocks. As she did, she found her exasperation had been replaced by tenderness and anger. This version of Jessie Mayhoot was older than the one who had been molested during the eclipse, but not much older. 12, perhaps 14 at the outside. At her age, she had no business being in stocks on the town common for any crime. But sexual enticement? Sexual enticement, for heaven's sake? What kind of a bad joke was that? How could people be so cruel, so willfully blind? "What do you want to tell me, Pumpkin?" "Only that it's real," the girl in the stock said. Her face was pale with pain, but her eyes were grave and concerned and lucid. "It's real. You know it is. And it will be back tonight. I think that this time it will do more than just look. You have to get out of the handcuffs before the sun goes down, Jessie. You have to be out of this house before it comes back." Once again she wanted to cry, but there were no tears. There was nothing but that dry, sandpapery sting. "I can't," she cried. "I've tried everything. I can't get out on my own." "You forgot one thing," the girl in the stocks told her. "I don't know if it's important or not, but it might be." "What?" The girl turned her hands over inside the holes which held them, exposing her clean pink palms. "He said there were two kinds, remember? M17 and F23. You almost remembered yesterday, I think. He wanted F-23s, but they don't make many, and they're hard to get, so he had to settle for two pairs of M-17s. You do remember, don't you? He told you all about it on the day he brought the handcuffs home. She opened her eyes and looked at the cuff which enclosed her right wrist. Yes, he certainly had told her all about it. Had, in fact, babbled like a coke addict on a two-pipe high, beginning with a late morning call from the office. He'd wanted to know if the house was empty. He could never remember which days the housekeeper had off. And when she assured him it was, he had asked her to slip into something comfortable. Something that's almost there, was the way he'd put it. She remembered being intrigued. Even over the phone, Gerald had sounded ready to blow a fuse, and she had suspected he was thinking kinky. That was all right with her. They were closing in on their 40s, and if Gerald wanted to experiment a little, she was willing enough to accommodate him. He had arrived in record time. He must have left all 3 miles of the 295 city bypass smoking behind him, she thought. And what Jesse remembered best about that day was how he had gone bustling about the bedroom, cheeks flushed and eyes sparkling. Sex wasn't the first thing that came to her mind when she thought of Gerald. In a word association test, security would probably have popped out first. But that day the two things had been all but interchangeable. Certainly sex had been the only thing on his mind. Jesse believed his usually polite attorney's pecker would have ripped the fly out of his gabardine slacks if he'd been any slower getting them off. Once they and the shorts beneath had been discarded, he had slowed down a little, ceremoniously opening the Adidas sneaker box he'd brought upstairs with him. He'd brought out the 2 sets of handcuffs which had been inside and held them up for her inspection. A pulse had been fluttering in his throat. A flickery little movement, almost as fast as a hummingbird's wing. She remembered that, too. Even then his heart must have been under a strain. "You would have done me a big favor, Gerald, if you'd popped your cork right then and there." She wanted to be horrified at this unkind thought about the man with whom she had shared so much of her life, and found the most she could manage was an almost clinical self-disgust. And when her thoughts returned to how he'd looked that day, those flushed cheeks and sparkling eyes, her hands curled quietly into hard little fists. "Why couldn't you leave me alone?" she asked him now. "Why did you have to be such a prick about it? Such a bully?" "Never mind. Don't think about Gerald. Think about the cuffs. 2 sets of Krieg security hand restraints, size M17. The M designation for male, the 17 for the number of notches on the latch locks." A sensation of bright heat bloomed in her stomach and chest. "Don't feel that," she told herself. That was impossible, however. It was hope she felt, and it wouldn't be denied. The best she could do was balance it with reality, keep reminding herself of her first failed attempt to squeeze out of the cuffs. Yet in spite of her efforts to remember the pain and failure, what she found herself thinking about was how close, how fucking close, she had come to escape. Another 1/4 inch might have been enough to turn the trick, she had thought then, and a 1/2 would have done it for sure. The bony outcrops below her thumbs were a problem, yes, but was she actually going to die on this bed because she was unable to bridge a gap not much wider than her upper lip? Surely not. Jesse made a strong effort to set these thoughts aside and return her mind to the day Gerald had brought the cuffs home. To how he had held them up with the wordless awe of a jeweler, displaying the finest diamond necklace to ever pass through his hands. She had been fairly impressed with him herself, come to that. She remembered how shiny they had been, and how the light from the window had pricked gleams of light off the blued steel of the cuffs, and the notched curves of the latch locks, which allowed one to adjust the handcuffs to wrists of various sizes. She'd wanted to know where he'd gotten them. It was a matter of simple curiosity, not accusation. But all he would tell her was that one of the courthouse sharpies had helped him out. He dropped her a hazy little half-wink when he said it, as if there were dozens of these shifty fellows drifting through the various halls and antechambers of the Cumberland County Courthouse, and he knew them all. In fact, he'd behaved that afternoon as if it had been a couple of Scud missiles he'd scored instead of 2 pairs of handcuffs. She had been lying on the bed, dressed in a white lace teddy and matching silk hose, an ensemble which was most definitely almost there, watching him with a mixture of amusement, curiosity, and excitement. But amusement had held the pole position that day, hadn't it? Yes. Seeing Gerald, who always tried so hard to be Mr. Cool, go striding around the room like a horse in heat had struck her as very amusing indeed. His hair had been frizzed up in the wild corkscrews Jesse's kid brother used to call chickens, and he'd still been wearing his black nylon dress for success socks. She remembered biting the insides of her cheeks, and quite hard, too, to keep her smile from showing. Mr. Cool had been talking faster than an auctioneer at a bankruptcy sale that afternoon. Then, all at once, he had stopped in mid-spiel. An expression of comic surprise had overspread his face. "Gerald, what's wrong?" she had asked. "I just realized that I don't even know if you want to consider this," he had replied. "I've been prattling on and on. I'm just about frothing at the you-know-what, as you can plainly see, and I never once asked you if..." She had smiled then, partially because she'd gotten very bored with the scarves and hadn't known how to tell him, but mostly just because it was good to see him excited about sex again. All right, it was maybe a little weird to get turned on by the idea of locking your wife up in handcuffs before going deep-sea diving with a long white pole. So what? It was just between the two of them, wasn't it? And it was all in fun. Really no more than an X-rated comic opera. Gilbert and Sullivan do bondage. I'm just a handcuffed lady in the King's Navy. Besides, there were weirder kinks. Freda Soames from across the street had once confessed to Jesse, after two drinks before lunch and half a bottle of wine during, that her ex-husband had enjoyed being powdered and diapered. Biting the insides of her cheeks hadn't worked the second time, and she had burst out laughing. Gerald had looked at her with his head cocked slightly to the right, and a little smile tilting up the left corner of his mouth. It was an expression she had come to know well over the last 17 years. It meant he was either preparing to be angry or to laugh along with her. It was usually impossible to tell which way he would tip. "Want a share?" he'd asked. She hadn't replied immediately. She stopped laughing instead, and fixed him with what she hoped was an expression worthy of the meanest Nazi bitch goddess ever to grace the cover of a man's adventure magazine. When she felt she had achieved the right degree of icy hauteur, she had raised her arms and said 5 uncalculated words, which had brought him leaping across to the bed, obviously dizzy with excitement. "Get over here, you bastard." In no time at all, he had been fumbling the cuffs onto her wrists and then attaching them to the bedposts. There were no slats on the headboard in the master bedroom of the Portland house. If he had suffered his heart attack there, she could have slipped the cuffs right off the tops of the posts. As he panted and fussed over the cuffs, one knee rubbing delightfully against her down below while he did it, he talked. And one of the things he told her was about M and F, and how the latchlocks worked. He had wanted F's, he told her, because the female cuffs had latchlocks with 23 notches instead of 17, the number most male cuffs had. More notches meant the female cuffs would close smaller. They were hard to come by, though, and when his courthouse friend had told Gerald he could get him 2 sets of men's hand restraints at a very reasonable price, Gerald had jumped at the chance. "Some women can pull right out of men's cuffs," he had told her, "but you're fairly big-boned. Besides, I didn't want to wait. Now, let's just see." He had snapped the cuff on her right wrist, pushing the latchlock in fast at first, but slowing down as he approached the end, asking her if he was hurting her as each notch clicked past. It was fine all the way to the last notch, but when he had asked her to try and get out, she hadn't been able to do so. Her wrist had slipped most of the way through the cuff all right, and Gerald had told her later that not even that was supposed to happen. But when it bound up along the back of her hand and at the base of her thumb, his comical expression of anxiety had faded. "I think they're going to do just fine," he had said. She remembered that very well, and she remembered what he'd said next even more clearly. We're going to have a lot of fun with these.
With the memory of that day still vivid in the front of her mind, Jessie once again began to apply downward pressure, trying to somehow shrink her hands enough so she could yank them through the cuffs. The pain struck sooner this time, starting not in her hands, but in the overtaxed muscles of her shoulders and arms. Jessie squeezed her eyes shut, bore down harder, and tried to shut out the hurt. Now her hands joined the chorus of outrage, and as she once more approached the outer limit of her muscular leverage, and the cuffs began to dig into the scant flesh which covered the backs of her hands, they began to scream. Posterior ligament, she thought. Head cocked, lips drawn back in a wide, spitless grin of pain. Posterior ligament. Posterior ligament, motherfucking posterior ligament. Nothing. No give. And she began to suspect, to strongly suspect, that there was more involved than ligaments. There were bones there as well. A couple of puky little bones running along the outsides of her hands below the lower thumb joint. A couple of puky little bones that were probably going to get her killed. With a final shriek of mingled pain and disappointment, Jessie let her hands go limp once more. Her shoulders and upper arms quivered with exhaustion. So much for sliding out of the cuffs, because they were M-17s instead of F-23s. The disappointment was almost worse than the physical pain. It stung like poisoned nettles. Shit and fuck! She cried at the empty room. Shit and fuck! Shit and fuck! Shit and fuck! Somewhere along the lake, farther off today by the sound, the chainsaw started up. And that made her even angrier. The guy from yesterday, back for more. Just some swinging dick in a red and black checked flannel shirt from L.L. Bean's, out there playing Paul Kiss My Ass Bunyan, roaring away with his McCulloch and dreaming about crawling into bed with his little honey at the end of the day. Or maybe it was football he was dreaming of, or just a few frosty cold ones down at the Marina Bar. Jessie saw the dork in the checked flannel shirt as clearly as she had seen the young girl in the stocks. And if thoughts alone could have killed him, his head would have exploded out through his asshole at that very moment.
It's not fair! She screamed. It's just not fair!
A kind of dry cramp seized her throat, and she fell silent, grimacing and afraid. She had felt the hard splinters of bone which barred her escape. Oh, God, had she! But she had been close just the same. That was the real wellspring of her bitterness, not the pain, and certainly not the unseen woodcutter with his blatting chainsaw. It was knowing that she had gotten close, but not quite close enough. She could continue to grit her teeth and endure the pain, but she no longer believed it would do her the slightest bit of good. That last quarter to half an inch was going to remain mockingly out of her reach. The only thing she could manage to do if she kept on pulling was to cause edema and swelling in her wrists, worsening her situation instead of bettering it. And don't you tell me I'm toast. Don't you dare, she said in a whispery, scolding voice. I don't want to hear that. You have to get out of them somehow, the young girl's voice whispered back. Because it really is going to come again. Tonight, after the sun goes down. I don't believe it, she croaked. I don't believe that man was real. I don't care about the footprint and the earring. I just don't believe it. Yes, you do. No, I don't. Yes, you do. Jessie let her head droop to one side, hair hanging almost down to the mattress, mouth quivering abjectly. Yes, she did.